Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. We're having a lot of fun this morning with the bus and the lights and everything. I'd like to introduce my colleague, Dr. Ayami Takahashi. She is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at the SIU School of Medicine and is also board certified through the American Board of Addiction Medicine. This project that we have is truly a multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary research effort because she and I come to this topic from very different perspectives. She comes from the medical field, I come from criminal justice, but we have an interest in this and found a way to sort of work together on it. I first want to mention that if somebody lost a ring in this room, I have found a ring, so you might want to hang around and come check with me. So Dr. Takahashi will talk a little bit about the theoretical framework, and then I will discuss our empirical findings. And if you would, we have a handout if you can just take a pile and start passing them around. Dr. Takahashi?
All right, so we got a Zoom. Okay. All right, so we have no relationships to disclose. We did this all with our own blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah.
Okay. So this first slide is just to demonstrate why we wanted to do this study, because there's this public hype and media perception, media hype as well, that, you know, violent video games plus mentally ill, taking antidepressants equals school shootings. And so we really wanted to look at the literature out there to see what's been done, what's been shown so far. And this is kind of what I found, is there's a body of literature on just mental illness and violence. So it's not about shootings, it's about all types of violence and mental illness in general. And then there's a whole body of literature on the social and cultural issues around school shootings. And then there's a substantial body of literature on just the rampage school shootings, which is actually a fairly small number of shootings at school in general. So what we wanted to do was look at that intersection of the three circles. So we wanted to look at all school shootings in general that we could find in the internet, which included some of the rampage school shootings, and we also wanted to look at, you know, what mention there was of any sort of mental illness. So these were our research questions. Number one, to what extent is mental illness present among these offenders in school shooting incidents? And number two, what is the relationship between mental illness and the various offender and contextual factors? All right, so just wanted to mention a little bit of the literature in each of those circles that I mentioned. The mental illness and violence literature, there's actually quite a lot available. One issue is the definition of severe mental illness. Most of the papers mention schizophrenia and bipolar disorder as the severe mental illness. Some mention severe depression, but those two diagnoses seems to come up the most. And in general, there may be some slight increase in risk of violence with the severe mental illness. However, it wasn't significant, is what most of these papers found. And only when there was comorbid substance abuse involved. And if you look at the substance abuse literature, of course, in general, substance abusers have an increased risk of violence, whether or not they have a mental illness or a diagnosed mental illness, let's say. Now, the Safe School Initiative was probably the most comprehensive body of work done on the rampage school shootings. It was a joint study between the U.S. Department of Education and the U.S. Secret Service, and it was initiated after the Columbine shootings, actually. And they studied 37 incidents between 74 and 2000. It had 41 attackers, and what they have found, I mean, it was a very detailed report, but only a third of the attackers had any history of a mental health evaluation, and one-fifth had actual diagnosed mental illness. And for example, you know, all the talk about psychotropics causing violence, et cetera, the kids who were shooters who had been on psychotropics had been non-compliant with their medicines also. And that's one thing that they had found. So there are many definitions of school shootings. And, for example, say rampage school shootings is defined by Newman and Fox as on a school property or related school function, the shooter is typically or must be a current or former student of the school, there must be multiple victims, and the victims may be chosen for symbolic significance or are shot at random. Now, the Safe School Initiative didn't call it rampage shootings. They called it targeted school violence. So these were school-based attacks where the school was deliberately selected as the location for the attack. And most of the time, there were one or two intended victims, and then they took out a whole bunch of people along with them. We picked up on these definitions, but also made it broader. So we defined it as they took place on school property in a specifically school-sponsored event. It didn't matter the number of victims, whether it was 0, 1, 2, or a rampage shooting. And with the evidence of mental illness, if a family member reported a diagnosis or they were taking a psychotropic medication, or the article reported a legal document that contained mental health information, or in number three, the police released a journal, Facebook page, or other material that indicated bizarre thinking, hearing voices, evidence of wanting to commit suicide. So those were our definitions. We excluded from our events, our count, the events that resulted from victims walking to and from school, and it had nothing to do with the school itself. Or if they were at a graduation party or non-school-sponsored event, we did not count those. Our reason for that was that, given the venue, these shootings could have taken place at any time and could be unrelated to the school day or school activities. But we did count the school shootings where the shooting took place immediately after a... So we didn't count as credible evidence if a neighbor said, oh, that person was crazy. Okay, so now we got to Zoom. All right, so we may...
Okay, so our data sources included the Bully Society, which many of you may be familiar with. Her list is online that you can access. The Brady Campaign has a list that is a good place to start, but not very detailed. Dr. Takahashi mentioned that we did... our research source was the Internet. So we would look up the name of the school and put in the shooting and put in the year and see what articles came up and then try to track those. If they went later, we had one case where an article a couple of years later actually found that the person who was, they were prosecuting as the offender, he got off, I shouldn't say it that way, he was released on a technicality. So technically, we don't know who the shooter was in that event. So we tried to track those, and we had a couple of institutional reports that are very lengthy. They're available online. And then, of course, Deadly Lessons from the National Academies Press. So we passed out some frequencies of the variables that we've been able to look at so far. And we have a lot of variables. We had 157 school shooting incidents that we looked at. You can see the number of victims and how they shake out. For a total of 403 students wounded or killed in that span of time. Okay, you've got this, so I'll skip over that. So we wanted to look at some specific things and see if there was any relationship with mental illness. We looked at some demographics. What was the relationship of the shooter to the school? What evidence could we find of mental illness? And also other risk factors. This is a very difficult kind of variable because we'd have one kid over here who they said was bullied and another kid over here who was gay bashing and another kid, well, a number of kids actually who were obsessed with Columbine, talked a lot about Columbine, drew pictures about Columbine. But they were very scattered over 157 incidents. So we created a variable that was just risk factors, trying to get a handle on it. And we found 46, almost 50% of the shooters had evidence of one or more of these risk factors. So those are warning signs. Those are things that we can see in children that we might be able to link up and think, well, I wonder if that child has this going on or is manifesting this Columbine effect, what our intern called the Columbine effect, and they're living in a home where there are guns, maybe we need to think about that, right? So the age range of the sample was 6 to 62, with but clearly the majority of these shootings being taking place with teenage shooters, a number of a disproportionate number of shooters being Black or African American, and those that came up because a number of the cases that had multiple offenders that the police ultimately caught more than one offender at a shooting incident were the majority of those were Black or African American, so that kind of bumped up that percentage a little bit of higher than it should have been. So in terms of mental illness, which is the We looked for a credible source. It wasn't like the neighbor said, oh, yeah, that kid's crazy. That wasn't good enough. We needed to have something that we thought was a credible source, and we found that 16.8, 17% did have evidence of mental illness from a credible source, which I was just realizing was pretty close to the 20% that your study found.
Yeah,
the Safe School Study Initiative.
Yeah.
So we also handed out a number of bivariate relationships on the third page, and some of these did show up as being significant. Mental illness with evidence of risk factors was a significant relationship. So it seems like it's kind of cumulative. There's some risk factors going on, and then if you add the mental illness in, that becomes a situation where the child is more likely to engage in this kind of behavior. We also found that the type of incident was significant. Children with mental illness or shooters with mental illness tended to be more likely to commit a shooting and suicide. So they would go to the school, shoot a couple of people, and then shoot themselves. And then the last one that we found was significant at this point is the weapon source, that a shooter with mental illness was more likely to get their gun from home. So those are the findings that we have so far. I don't expect, even though we know of some other shootings, because you'll read an article about a shooting at Ballou High School in Washington, D.C., and then later on in the story it'll say, oh yeah, there were these other two shootings. So we're trying to keep tracking that down and maybe even expand this study. But this is where we are right now, and not quite ready to go to press, but getting there. So what does this tell us?
Okay. So real quickly, you know, there's been a lot of arguments made for increased access to mental health. We need to change the culture in schools. We also need to reduce gun access. And again, it's not one thing. I think we need to do all of the above. It's what we're seeing through our going through all of this research, because it's not just mental illness that's causing the problem. It's not just gun access, because the kids typically get them from their parents, they steal them from neighbors, you know, get them from older peers who buy them from them. That's what I've found. And then access to mental illness, too, we have to reduce the stigma in terms of helping kids get that get the help that they need. Another thing that came out of the whole Adam Lanza shootings is that it was reported that he might have Asperger's, and so then there was this whole slew of stigmatizing of kids with Asperger's, and that sort of behavior actually prevents people from getting treatment because they don't want that stigma. But yeah. Anyway.
So then just to wrap up, we after dinner last night, we went to the the Hippie Dippy store that's down the street, which I highly recommend. It was very fun. But we found these pins that actually say, "Why is it harder to get mental health care than it is to buy a gun?"
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Questions for, did you want to say something else?
No, what was the question?
Yes, where
absolutely.
Should we start? Over here.
Mm-hmm. We don't know. I mean, that's kind of what we think might be going on. You get halfway through the year, and it's right after the holidays too. So you kind of go, you know, we all kind of go in that little dip after the holidays, and for these kids, maybe that dip is a little bit lower, and so, or maybe something happened over the holidays, you know, when families all get together and crazy stuff happens. Maybe that's enough to sort of knock the kids far enough that they're already thinking about it. We have evidence that they're already thinking about it. They don't just wake up one morning and say, "I'm going to get the gun and go shoot people." They are already planning it. The evidence is very clear. They plan it for a month. They plan it for 6 months. They plan it for a year. But maybe that's the thing that knocks them over the edge.
Right, and we just came up to answer questions.
This is a question I kind of have that is kind of just, you'll just have to think about it. When I lived in Washington, D.C., and I used to go to Anacostia High School and some of the high schools, I'll tell you, going into the high schools themselves where you have to go through the
metal
security
detector
checks and having police officers on every corner, every, not block, every
hallway.
Thank you. You know, I'll tell you, it's got to have some effect. Do any of you have any thoughts about what does this also do for our young people? I mean, I'm almost 70, and it was, you know, I just had a joy in being able to walk in your hallways
mm-hmm.
at school, and now it feels like you're just in a prison when
sure.
you're in the school. What effect does that also have on our young people?
Yeah. Well, I think it probably causes people not to emphasize the education, you know. It's more like a place you have to go to get through it all. And there actually is a body of literature on averted school shootings and the characteristics of the schools where that's happened. Again, it's a hard area to study, but what they found is that those schools, there was a much more community-oriented feeling, that the teachers knew their kids well, they kept in touch with the families, they had frequent contact with the families. There's also now many schools have adopted having like a safety officer. So instead of having the police and the metal detector and all that, they have one designated safety officer whose position isn't to be punitive or be like a police officer, but to be somebody that the kids could go to if they're having issues, or having like a suggestion box, you know, where they drop in, you know, comments or even things about what's going on if they don't want to in person tell an adult. So when they increase that culture of communication, then the kids come and start talking to somebody. You know, so I'm not sure that the metal detectors and the police officer in every hallway isn't actually somewhat counterproductive.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I just had a thought about it. So before Baltimore, I worked in Chicago, and I've often asked schools why they have this, and it was usually reactive. So they had an event, and they thought that this was the best way to keep everybody safe afterwards. So, yes, while I agree, it probably feels like, oh, my gosh, I feel like I'm being criminalized. It was seen as a protective measure, really, not necessarily. Perhaps the unintended consequence was that people are feeling like they're in a prison or being criminalized. But they also felt like they were protecting people. So guns aren't coming in. And so, of course, other proponents would say, oh, but people are stabbing folks with pins. And it's like, okay.
You have to kill somebody with an ink pen.
Yeah, right. But I'm just saying, it's been viewed as a protective measure.
Yes.
I think it's interesting thinking about, you know, this sort of library discussion, and I'm thinking about the terms of STRIDE and job readiness programs, is there a move there to think more about individual placement and support approaches as opposed to kind of classroom-oriented, getting people ready to work?
There wasn't, not to my knowledge, there wasn't. And it may be in part because the folks who come there aren't, again, similar to the first, and maybe even you guys, there isn't a history of mental health.
Right.
So they haven't been diagnosed with something. So the approach at Shrive, I guess this idea of thinking about mental health integration came because they saw that, like, man, like, we can't address some of the issues that you have. But we think we can find somebody who can. So I think that the model that you're talking about might work better for folks who have either been in therapy or have a diagnosis and are also trying to work. And there is a body of literature that, to your point, that suggests that that works. But I think what Shrive is, their thinking around this is that there are people, we know that they have more issues. Like, we don't necessarily now have the capacity to address them. We want to, and we want to figure out how to address it without, like you said, stigmatizing folks or making people feel like they have to go to 85 different other places to get the services that they need. So. So interesting, that's a great question, because the reason this project started was because our partners were saying, like, we really only look at whether or not people get jobs, and if they get jobs, how long do they stay in those jobs, because we are a workforce development program. And this project really was a push for them to say, wait a minute, like, maybe we should be looking at other outcomes besides job training. So we don't know yet, like, how to do that. This is a very small study, so we're thinking about, like, how might we... if they're already trying to track folks, and that has its own set of issues, about where people are working and how long they work there, how might we also integrate some of these other components? But this is almost like a baseline step for them. So, but you're right, I think that tracking folks across time and to see, oh wait, we've integrated these mental health services and we've been able to show that this, in conjunction with our workforce development program, has effects above and beyond with our workforce development program. So yeah, I agree. I think that would be a great next step.
So I thought the finding on race and ethnicity in suicide was interesting, but I thought what was more interesting is that there were 99 missing data for race, right, and ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of speaks to media portrayal of certain aspects of mental illness.
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe we should just start singing. You know, I really hadn't thought very far about that issue. One of the problems with this research is that the only way that we can know what the race of the person was is if it's in the newspaper article. And if there's a picture, you know, I usually can tell from the picture, oh, okay, that person is clearly this or clearly that. But I'm just going to have a lot of missing data in that variable, so I'm not sure what I can do with it since there's just no way to get that. I mean, I thought about calling police departments and trying to, you know, but I'm not sure exactly I don't know if they'll be responsive. I did call a couple of newspaper places to see if I could get to kind of explore how that would go. And it was the archive, you can call it archivist. And this one archivist said to me, well, you may have trouble with this because these stories don't always get legs. That's what she called it. They don't always get legs because we don't want to blow it out of, you know, have a whole lot of follow-up. So you'll have a little tiny article that this school shooting took place, and if there was nobody hurt or if there was just one person, but one person killed, they'll put it in the paper once, and then you'll never see it again. So, yeah, it's a good point, though. That's a really good point. Yeah, we'll have to think about that.
Yeah.
Okay, which one are you looking at? The motive?
The evidence of mental illness, all the 16% on the bottom of the second page.
Oh, okay.
Get that one.
Oh. Okay, thanks. well, part of this is, part of that number. Well, most of that number is going to be the fact that the data is not there. The only way that the media would pick that up, they love to pick it up in a rampage shooting because there's a lot of victims and it's very horrifying. And so then they go right in and they start digging out, you know, information about the shooter. But again, if it's one of these cases and the majority of these cases have zero or one or two victims, and they report it once, and they don't go in any more detail than that. And once in a while, you do read the thing, the neighbor said the kid was crazy and doing this and doing that. Not going to count that. So a good part of that number is the fact that we just don't have access to that data. It's not on the web, which is not probably a bad thing.
I don't necessarily find that surprising.
Right.
Something major usually has to happen before someone starts entertaining those kinds of diagnoses.
Yeah, that's true.
And it frequently happens in late teens, early 20s, so I don't know that that's necessarily surprising. It may be more accurate to say that there's no prior history. Of
exactly,
mental
no prior history.
Big break.
Right. Yeah.
Geographic.
Geographically?
Geographically, and then temporally as well, and any relationship with the amount of media coverage for the incident and related to subsequent shooting.
We haven't looked at that. We do have data on, we put in the city, and then one of the interns looked up the population of all these cities, and then we also have put in a variable of the number of children under the age of 18, because that's a proxy for some socioeconomic measures, but we haven't looked at those things yet. Those are really good questions. Yeah. Great.
Mental illness includes ADD, ADHD, yeah. Anxiety, depression. And it's my understanding in the literature that the most dangerous aspects are actually psychosis. So I think if you could benefit in your research by distinguishing psychosis separate from bipolar and schizophrenia, which aren't really dangerous disorders, it's psychosis aspects of many kinds of disorders. You can experience psychosis with depression that may help elucidate your argument.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah. We'll have to. Thank you.
Can I just help us all, because we're here because we care about young people, and I'm in the state of Maine. I live in Maine, Portland, Maine, and we in our state had a real issue with human sexual trafficking of teenagers, and it's not an issue just in our state. It's actually much more widespread, and in the state, people are getting more and more informed about it. And it's just for us all to keep this kind of on our... I'm a physician assistant, so we're trying to help all our clinicians to really be more attentive to issues like this. Just to give you an example, one of the people who had been trafficked had two babies, and that would have been a wonderful opportunity when she was in being seen, but it was never picked up. And I actually, as we're learning more, but I just wanted to bring it here because everyone here probably cares very much about our youth.
I just wanted to build on the comment about psychosis, and it's not necessarily the presence of psychosis that will increase the risk, but it's when you overlay substance abuse on them. So I think that's an important message to get across.
That's definitely what's out there in the literature also.
that substance abuse alone increases the risk dramatically, regardless of diagnosis.
Right, but if you have psychosis, you're not necessarily at increased risk for committing violence.
Correct.
Unless you're also
abusing. Yeah, and there, in the school shooting literature, they have the 5 necessary factors that you need in order for one of these shootings to occur. And, you know, of course, number 1 is gun access. And what were the other 5?
Oh, there's, we have this.
Yeah. Been there. Yeah.
Those of you who know the Newman Rampage research, it's gun availability, lack of a social structure to prevent these kinds of incidents.
And then social isolation.
Right.
Feeling,
a perception of, oh, here we go.
Here we go.
Gun availability. Availability and adherence to a particular cultural script that supports a school shooting in the shooter's mind. A third, perception by the shooter of an extremely marginal social position within social worlds that are important to him. I kind of question that because in my research, in our research, there were a number of these kids who were not loners. They had friends. They were good. They were getting good grades. They were not obvious risk factors. The only in some of those cases, some of them was like divorce would be the only real risk factor that was in the newspaper article. So I'm not sure about this number 3, but anyway, number 4, an individual problem that magnifies the impact of the shooter's social marginalization. So that's where the mental illness comes in. So it's kind of sounds it's kind of cumulative. Family problems, history of abuse. Or even a recent breakup, a you know relationship that went south. And 5, failure of social support systems that are intended to catch troubled teens before their problems are so extreme as to lead to a school shooting. So that's what's in the Rampage shooting literature that they've found to be the contextual elements that contribute to these school shootings.
Yeah, so it probably applies to somebody with psychosis. They would have to have all multiple other factors kind of building in on them for them to do something, and it's going to be relatively rare given that there's not, I mean, it's not that common to have a psychotic disorder, and it's even less common to become violent.
Yeah, and that's another thing. We're talking about some of this, we've got some great articles are out there, I'm not bringing up, but you know, you have to remember that you're talking about a really tiny little number of these incidents, and they get a lot of press, but it's a very small number of all the homicides that are committed, all the shootings that are committed, the number, you know, the percentage of kids who are killed in a school shooting is tiny, and it's terrible when it happens, but it's hard to keep the media focused on the fact that, hey, this is really a rare occurrence, and, you know, that then spawns the, oh, we have to have, the, you know, the metal detectors, we have police, and you know, all of this is all that social construction of these kinds of incidents. So,
thank you all for your time.
Oh, thank you.